Hello and welcome to a nice joint production of Consumer Choice Radio and the Consumer Podcast. We're broadcasting on the radio, on podcast devices, thanks to Podcasting 2.0 and right there in your pocket. I am a part of the trio here today, Yael Osowski, broadcasting back from, a little bit of an Italian holiday in the studio, and I'm joined by my trusty colleague David Clement in Toronto. David, how goes it?
It's going well. It's going well. No complaints here. You were in Italy. I had a nice week away in Muskoka, enjoying the wonders of cottage country here in Ontario. So rested, relaxed. Did my first triathlon last week. Very excited about that. So things are good. Things are good. And we also have Bill Wirtz on the line here.
Indeed. We have our colleague Bill Wirtz. He's the host of the Consumer Podcast, which you can also subscribe to. Or if you guys are Bill's listeners, thank you for tuning in to Consumer Choice Radio. Bill, back at the mic. You also took a little bit of vacation recently.
Well, thanks for doing this together, guys, first of all. And this is actually episode 80 of the Consumer Podcast. So trying to catch up with you guys, but you're doing it every week. So it's really hard to catch up, actually. I was away a bit. I was in the United States trying out all the foods that presumably will poison us if we import them to Europe. So I'm still alive. So there seems to be nothing to this rumor.
Wow.
Boost.
This guy's on message. Doesn't matter where he goes. He keeps to the line. So way to go. So you had been to the U.S. Before, Bill, but was this the first time you'd visited the middle of the country?
Yeah, so I was in Chicago and then in Denver. And first time in both places. And I think, so Denver to me felt more of what I thought the U.S. was supposed to look like in a way, because, you know, the large, very large streets, the parking lots everywhere, everything is very car heavy. And in Chicago, I was actually able to use a bicycle. So there, the city seems to be transitioning into more of sort of a pedestrian, cycling friendly sort of situation, which, you know, if you spend most of your time in Amsterdam, it gets very strange to be so heavily reliant on the car.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about it. That's kind of the price you pay for living out in the West. But there's a reason that, you know, Colorado was the setting of Galt's Gulch in Atlas Shrugged. For those of you who read that, it was the pioneer territory, right? There was nothing to conquer out there, or there was everything to conquer out there. And now it's a nice little bustling metropolis. I like Denver a lot. Did you get over to Boulder by any chance?
I did not. I keep hearing about it in usually songs, but it wasn't too far. But then again, you know, if you're out of car, then walking to Boulder would probably not have been an option. Maybe next time.
Very cool. So, Bill, you brought us already a topic talking about the food, the agriculture in the United States. You got to taste the food, those beautiful, delicious GMOs you can't get elsewhere. I guess we can start with that. And then I've got a couple of things here in the rundown. If you guys want to look at that, and then we can go from there. So, tell us the culinary experience that you had.
So the portion sizes will never cease to amaze me. This was the fourth time I was in the United States, and each time I order something, you know, you make this mistake. You would, you know, two people as a couple, you're ordering something, and then you think each ordered their own. But essentially what you have to do is just share a plate, because the portions are so large. And it seems that Americans just sort of approach this from a perspective of like, we'll have the rest for dinner, because everybody gets the rest of the food to go. It's not everybody finishes their plate, so that's not how they do it. And I think that's very strange. Also,
it's a strange world out there.
Exactly, it is. Thanks, Bernie. And then also what I can't wrap my head around is the tipping culture. I mean, that is just like making me responsible for what people are being paid. I find that slightly strange, because I don't exactly know where I'm supposed to tip and how much of it. I don't know. Do you guys have, David, do you guys have that in Canada as well? How do you have to establish sort of a golden rule what you do?
So, yeah, I mean, there is tipping culture here in Canada. I'd say standard is like 15%. It can go as high as 20%. Depending on how good the service is, I'm unclear on whether tipping culture is good, because I do somewhat like the service incentive that you get in North America, where People kind of go above and beyond because they know that there's a little bit of extra money that's dependent on it. And so that's a positive thing. But at the same time, like you said, Bill, it does put a lot of pressure on you. And then I have seen some scenarios where people tip low and then like the manager of the restaurant or the server is like, hey, was something wrong? Like, did we not do a good enough job? Which could certainly be awkward.
Wow. That's
well. Usually the manager doesn't usually step in on behalf of the server. But yeah, I think that's probably happened.
I was also wondering, does it? I got the feeling that the waiters do come back to the table a lot to ask if we want more things, not just because they're friendly, but because you tip in percentages. There's sort of an incentive to sell you as much as possible, no?
Well, I guess now I'll have to give you a little lesson from the kitchen, Bill, because I was a waiter there for a couple years. You obviously have the incentive to upsell as much as possible. So not drinking water. I need to get you on soda. I need to get you a beer. How about a cocktail? I need you to get that appetizer. Because then instead of your bill being, you know, $19, yeah. If I can get up to $45,
well, and it's...
then I know I'm going to get more. And the history of it is interesting, too, because it was in French, you know, we say pourboire, and the same with German, Trinkgeld, drink money. And like the whole history of it back in the day was that you're out at the pub, you're drinking, you're having fun, but the server, the waiter, you know, he's having to work. So you gave him a little bit so he could enjoy a beer, you know, in his off time.
Yeah. And one of the things you'll notice, I don't know if you ordered any burgers while you were out. You sit down at a restaurant and you order a burger and it's, you'd be like, oh, and would you like bacon? And I'm like, oh, I didn't think about that. Maybe I do. And there's a bit of an extra charge. What about cheese? You're like, yeah, you know what? I would like some cheese. And next thing you know, you've added $4 to your burger. So you do see a lot of that.
Yeah, and that's why people hear my accent whenever I'm in a certain area, and they love to see that American going around Europe because the expectation is you're going to be leaving big tips for everybody. So speaking of tips, I'll tell you where they did not leave any tips. At the G7 in Munich, Germany. I wanted to talk about this a little bit because most people don't really cover these large political sort of meetings. Who knows really what's happening there? But we got more of an inside here. We got a couple of clips that came from some of the interviews that the world leaders were doing. So this is the major, you know, G7 countries. We saw Justin Trudeau doing some interviews, Boris Johnson, obviously Joe Biden. Probably couldn't get him for an interview. He was kind of walking off. But we do have some very interesting clips that came out of that. And there was a couple interesting insights. Apparently, they're all little mini comedians, you know, because this is the ongoing trend in our society, guys. Don't you know that if you want good political comedy, you just listen to politicians. But if you want, you know, great, amazing political analysis and insights, you listen to comedy and comedians on late night television. So I don't know if we'll be able to hear this clip. This is the one that Bill sent in. This is the G7 leader sitting down and kind of joking about making a Putin shirtless photo. Yeah, we probably terrible quality for the podcast and radio show here, but yeah, it's all the focus on what's happening with Russia, and then we also have this nice little clip between Macron and Biden. I'm pretty sure he did not intend to have this being recorded, but there's a clip of Macron going up to Biden and telling him about you know, our oil partners in the Middle East. Let's see if we can hear this. It's a little better to understand.
Joe. Joe.
You predicted it for a while.
Excuse me. Sorry to interrupt you.
With your advisor, I took the commission to call MBZ. So I call for increasing the production.
So you probably can't hear it too much, but he's talking about essentially he talked to the leader of the United Arab Emirates, who had talked to the Saudis, basically saying that they're pretty much at peak capacity. They can't really put out any more barrels. And in the end, he gives a nice little nudge to Joe, being like, yeah, it'd be great to have some American oil you guys can export to help out the world there a little bit.
So,
what do you guys think of that clip?
I don't think, by the way, that Macron did this mistakenly. I mean, the journalists are just a couple of meters away. I think this was done on purpose to put pressure on, is for people to genuinely hear this. And again, you can find the videos online with the subtitles, and it's very interesting how Macron talks to Biden about this and how Biden actually tries to get out of the conversation, probably aware that there are cameras and microphones around. So I do think this was...
You think he's that aware, Bill?
I'd like to give him credit for probably trying to avoid this conversation, as most politicians probably would like to, especially on this issue. So I do think Macron was trying to make a point here that there's a genuine need for American exports when it comes to oil. And I think the numbers really back that up. And Macron also has sort of this face of, well, we're kind of at the end of the road here in terms of our options if sort of the Emirates and the Saudis can't deliver.
Yeah, it was very much like, we need you now, Joe. We need you to pull through here. Please save the day. And the thing is, in the U.S. context, is the back and forth I've seen. I mean, you have progressives being like, wow, the oil companies have record profits, blah, 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 blah. But it's like, this isn't just like turning on the taps per se. There's like infrastructure spending that needs to happen. And I think on some side of the industry, they're saying, okay, but we need certainty that like you're also not going to end our industry in the next 10 years like you campaigned on, because we're not going to dump billions of dollars into expanding all of this only for you to turn off the taps when the conflict, the invasion in Ukraine is over, and let's say the Ukrainians have won, or Russia retreats, or whatever the end result is, or the Europeans are fully off of Russian gas. Like, what happens next? And I don't think the Biden administration has given them enough certainty to be like, okay, forget what we said. That was prior to this disaster. We're in a new world here, and we're going to regulate accordingly.
Yeah, I think that's a strong point. I was going to play a clip, David, but you weren't there, about from Jennifer Granholm, who is the Secretary of Energy in the U.S., who's the one who did campaign against the oil companies, oil exploration. Also was born in Canada, David. I didn't know that, but she's a Canadian citizen as well, and she's a big position. She's a BC gal.
So what you're saying is we are not sending our best.
They're not sending their best.
We are not sending our best. I mean, between her and then on the Republican side, David Frum, we are not sending our best, apparently.
Yeah, I could have said Ted Cruz, but I looked into it. There have been 22 American politicians who were born in Canada. It's kind of interesting. There's a couple of reps as well, a couple of current House reps, most of them born to American parents. So really, Jennifer Granholm is the only, pure dyed-in-the-wool Canadian. So the G7 stuff still going on. I'm sure there'll be some strange announcements, some energy stuff that'll be talked about. I know I wrote an article really hoping that Joe Biden would turn into the gas salesman, the oil salesman now, because the war is still going on. And the inflationary pressures, particularly in the energy markets, are not looking good. Probably my energy rates are going to raise here very soon, which I'm not happy about. And it's not looking good. I don't know, Bill, if you got any closing thoughts here before we go to break.
Well, I do think, you tell us how much time we have before the break, but I did find it interesting that all the talk about oil is being had while the leaders are flying up to the mountain for the G7 and taking journalists with them. And Politico actually did have an interesting article there about it, where they say that there was actually no time being saved compared to going up there by bus, and journalists were taken up there with a helicopter that burns 1,000 liters of fuel, I think, in a minute. So that's pretty crazy and quite the irony.
Yeah, ironic indeed. Ironic indeed, just like having ads on a podcast, having a commercial break, which we'll have right here. You guys continue listening to our joint consumer podcast, Consumer Choice Radio. We'll be right back after this. And we're back here on Consumer Choice Radio, a joint podcast here with the Consumer Podcast. Bill was telling us about the helicopter that the G7 leaders were taking up to the mountains at the same time that they're talking about energy. They're trying to find alternative sources for oil and gas for the European continent so we don't have to pay the Russians anymore. And meanwhile, all the administrations are, you know, still clinging to the climate policies that really mean they're not supposed to be doing any of that stuff. But we can see that the tune has changed.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wish we would just have someone who would refreshingly say, hey, the climate stuff's going to be on hold for a little bit because we have bigger issues and we don't want to fund the Russian war machine. So we're going to maybe put a pause on some of our lofty goals that we campaigned on in the interim because you can't really have it both ways. It's very difficult. It's very difficult for Joe Biden to expand oil exports and production and then at the same time hold some of his campaign pledges. And I mean, just given the economic turmoil and the rising cost of living, it would probably be a good time politically for Biden to pivot to like the Bill Clinton, it's the economy, stupid type of Democratic approach. Will he do that? I don't know. But that would probably be the best route.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know, though. There's a lot of, I don't know if you guys heard, but there's some distracting things happening in the United States. You know, apparently democracy has died, according to Wanda Sykes. Sorry, I'm going to play this now because I figured we're already talking a little bit about democracy and things dying. And I already mentioned the politicians making jokes, and then the comedians are the ones doing politics.
Longer a democracy, right? I mean, it's no longer majority rule.
No, certainly not right? In the Senate. Certainly not in the representation from the Supreme
Court. It's not. It's no longer majority rule. And I mean, it's like these judges that they basically lied when they were, you know, doing their confirmation hearings, right?
Yeah. Especially Kavanaugh.
Well, to me, it's like the problem is that middle stuff. It's those states in the middle, that red stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they get to tell us what to do when the majority of us live out, you know, New York, California, and we're paying for all this crap, really? I mean, right?
Yeah.
We're footing the bill.
Well, that's the union. It's supposed to be representative democracy, but it turns out to be minority rule right now.
Right.
And coming up next, Justin Bieber with his next track.
Yeah, Bill. Okay, so yeah, I mean, the thing when she says that, why are they making the rules for us? So I think the Roe v. Wade overturning is not good. You're going to see some very restrictive bills in Republican states be re-implemented. There's a whole host of negative consequences. I find the very strident pro-life position to be quite naive. But this is not red states telling blue states what to do. It's telling the states to do whatever they want, and so the blue states can still do the blue things. That type of analysis, I'm like, well, you don't really understand that, like, New York can still have whatever laws it wants on, let's say, reproductive rights. Texas is going to be different. But Texas is not telling New York to change their law. I think the Texas law is bad, but you got to realize what the overturning of Roe v. Wade is and what it isn't. And I mean, it's like a lot of people just fail the civics class.
I think we should do a quiz with people and actually use the script from what we just heard and then ask people, was this said by a conservative in 2015 when the Supreme Court overturned the rules on same-sex marriage, or was this done after Roe v. Wade? Because this could equally have been said by a conservative when same-sex marriage was allowed in the US. And so the consistency doesn't really apply. Everybody believes in sort of what regions or states should be allowed to do whenever it suits them. It's too political. It's not really based on sort of what the principle ought to be.
Well, yeah, same for cannabis and many other topics.
Yeah, and the flip of that would be, right, if you got rid of the Electoral College and you allocated Senate seats based on population, you'd have New York and Texas deciding what the red state, what life looks like. You could have people in red states saying the exact same thing, being like, well, why do people in California and New York get to decide what the land use regulations are in Iowa?
Well, that's federalism. And the point is, everybody hates it because nobody has absolute majority rule. That's kind of the point. That's a major so-called problem in the European Union, right? That member states still have power bill, which I know you cover a lot, which is very problematic for central planners who would like to implement one rule for everybody. But this stuff is messy, and that's probably a good thing.
Absolutely. And I mean, the European Union even has stronger rules because, as far as I understand, it's not that the state can veto legislation done federally in Washington, D.C., but in the European
Union.
Well,
last time we did that, we had a civil war. That was nullification, but we won't talk about that.
but in any way, I mean, on specific legislation, individual member states can just say no. And if one member state in the European Union says no, it won't go through. And that's even a stronger sort of system compared to what the U.S. has. But I mean, ultimately, the question would be, why would member nations in the European Union sign up for this? Because, you know, I'm from Luxembourg, a very small country. So if you went by population size, then also we would be outvoted by Germany each time. So sort of the reason why individual countries are a member of this is because the rules were made in a way to appeal to them to join in the first place. So it's my understanding as well that sort of the Electoral College, or also the way that the Senate is organized in the US, is by that representational system where it's two per state, not according to population size.
Yeah, and it's a bicameral legislature, right? So you have the House version, you have the Senate, and that's the whole point.
And what I'm about to say will probably make a lot of Democrats or progressives fume, but like, the way in which the Senate is allocated allowed for Joe Manchin to save the nation from an additional like $6 trillion of federal spending and the further inflationary impact of that. And so, I mean, that is consequentially one good outcome of the fact that West Virginia happens to have two senators, and the way in which the Senate broke down is he got to be the voice of reason in between the Democrats and Republicans, saying maybe we need to hold the presses for a little bit and take our foot off the gas on spending.
I think where some of the people who criticize sort of these veto powers or this way in which the system worked have a point is when, you know, politics gets really in the way of what the actual issue is. So I think in the case where specific U.S. senators oppose or approve a bill, it doesn't necessarily have to do with them agreeing on it, but having played politics on issues that they support. So for instance, in the European Union, we have similar things. So I know that when the UK was a member of the EU, Spain was vetoing legislation that the UK wanted because Spain and the UK are still fighting over this island, this half island of Gibraltar. So just because of that, everything that came out of the UK when it came to legislation was blocked by Spain. It had nothing to do with the actual issue. It's just blocked because for the sake of it. And so that happens. Sort of these trade-offs happen where we don't know why was this vote taken in this way. We don't have actual transparency on how the politicians were acting.
Oh, yeah, indeed. And I wanted to play actually a small clip of good old Boris Johnson. So he was at the G7 event as well and had a little sit down with Jake Tapper. And he talks a little bit about democracy, and the sort of media class is stating that the U.S. looks like it's just lost all democracy. What do you think about that, Boris? And I think he had some very good insights.
We're here at the G7, a gathering of the world's leading democracies. When I talk to friends in Canada, the UK, Australia, and elsewhere, people express concern about the United States as...
The United States.
About the United States in terms of our ability and our institutions to thrive and continue after what happened with the election of 2020. They worry that democracy is on life support in the United States. People might not know this about you, but you were born in the United States, and until recently...
I was. And I was born in New York City, a fantastic place. Jake, where were you born in New York?
Where was I? Staten Island.
All right, okay. I was born in New York General Hospital.
Are you worried at all? Do you look?
No, I want to say this to the people of the United States. I'm not. I think that I just get back to what I've been trying to say to you throughout this interview. I think that reports of the death of democracy in the United States are grossly exaggerated. America is a shining city on a hill, and for me, and it will continue to be so. And I think that the mere fact that Joe Biden has stepped up to the plate in the way that he has shows that the instincts of America are still very much in the right place.
So yeah, there's a lot more where that came from, but Bill, I was curious as to your thoughts. You're a BJ watcher, as they call it, Bojo watcher. What do you think of that?
I don't think I want to necessarily have BJ watcher as a title of mine, but I think he makes a good point there. I mean, I think Americans, when you know, if you tune into CNN or any of the major networks, you get the impression that you know the US is falling apart and the institutions are falling apart. I mean, sure, you shouldn't necessarily look abroad and do international comparisons, but I mean, if you do international comparisons, then the US is really there's no rivalry there. There's actually a system where a court, individual counties and states can oppose rules that they don't like, make choices for themselves, have a lot of individuality, which you don't really get. I mean, if you look at a country like France, everything is being done in Paris. The president decides everything. You build a bridge in the south of France and you still need to get it approved in Paris. You don't have that sort of thinking and system in the US. And you have a lot of decision making that is done at the grassroots. It's actually so interesting to see that one of the examples that people give when they say like, oh, the system is not working is because there's some of these crazy people going to these town halls or hearings. It's like in many countries, you don't even get a hearing to go to your local authority to complain about anything. And Americans have that enormous privilege to be able to participate. So I think he's absolutely right there in his analysis.
Good old Boris Johnson, good man.
On the Canadian side, there's always a hint of anti-Americanism in some of the fanatical coverage we see about Canadian or U.S. democracy. And what I find so irritating is that the people most likely to say that like the U.S. is falling into dictatorship and democracy is dying are the same people who don't care that the Trudeau government replaced an attorney general to get a preferred outcome on a corporate scandal, because if that scandal had gone a different way, it may have hurt them politically in Quebec. And we're seeing this again with the RCMP, which is kind of like the Canadian FBI, and undue influence from the Prime Minister's office in regards to details about a mass shooting, and putting pressure on them to essentially help them politically with firearms legislation. I mean, those are some pretty serious violations of democratic norms, which rely on the autonomy of the judicial system or law enforcement. And so you have people being like, oh, the U.S. is slipping into dictatorship. It's becoming the Handmaid's Tale. While at the same time excusing the very shady behavior we see out of the Prime Minister's office. And I think the only reason why it carries any water here is because there's just that underlying hint of anti-Americanism in Canadian politics, where it's fashionable to over-exaggerate or highlight how awful the U.S. is.
Common trait in European systems as well. We see that with the tech companies. We see that with, you know, trying to castigate Ireland for not taxing Facebook enough or Apple or anything else. Bill, you know those battles well. Bill, we got a minute to go here before our break. Why don't you update the listeners a bit on sort of what you're working on and the things that are right now on your radar?
Well, so I recently wrote, and I think with David, we talked already about this. I had recently an article published on targeted advertising, why I don't think it's actually that terrible. Interesting read there. You can look into that on my Newsmax profile. For the rest, just the regular content on agriculture and sort of the myths that go around on pollinators. And please do follow the Consumer Podcast as well. That's spelled with EU and available wherever you're listening to right now, unless you're on the radio, in which case you actually have to use a podcast app.
Indeed. All right. Thank you so much, Bill. Thank you guys for tuning into our joint venture. We got another segment for Consumer Choice Radio, but that's it for Consumer Podcast. Thank you guys so much.